My name is Dewey Bissell, and it is February 26th today, 1988, and I have with me, seated across the table, J. Robert Hansen, who is a professor of music at Concordia College and conductor of the FM Symphony. Bob, welcome.
Thank you very much, Dewey.
Just some quick questions on biographical nature first, Bob. Could you tell us a little bit where you were born and when you were born and a little bit about your background?
I was born in Osakis, Minnesota in 1929, October 24th to be exact, and that of course was the year of the Great Crash, so it's an important year for a couple of reasons. I grew up there and came to Concordia College after graduating from high school in 1947 and graduated from Concordia College in 1951. I went right from there to the University of Iowa, spent 2 years working on a master's and a Master of Fine Arts degree in music, and then spent 2 years in the service. Came back to Iowa and stayed there until I finished my doctorate in 1958, and in the meantime became an instructor there for 3 years. And I'm kind of running through the whole life here.
That's good. That's what we need.
And in 1959, moved to University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Spent the next 7 years there teaching at the university and also playing with the Milwaukee Symphony. And in 1966, received a kind of a call, I guess you would say, from Concordia, my alma mater, and came back to teach here and conduct the band and start the orchestra. And that has been the story of my life for the past 20 years, 22 years actually. So,
I'd forgotten it. You were the first conductor of the college orchestra here.
Yes.
There wasn't a college orchestra prior to your arrival.
Right.
Oh, I'd forgotten that, Bobby.
Fargo-Moorhead Symphony was conducted by Sigvald Thompson, and he was, of course, a member of the staff at Concordia also. And it was any string student at that time played in the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony for their ensemble credit.
I see.
So that it was kind of a joint venture. And I think it was 1967-68 year that we actually started a Concordia Chamber Orchestra from scratch and with a very small group and has developed into a full-size symphony now.
Well, let's go back a little bit in your biographical sketch of your life. You were at Concordia. What year was it you graduated?
1951.
And you were, of course, studying trumpet at that time, and then you went from there directly to Iowa, you said, and your Iowa stay was interrupted with a hitch in the service,
mm-hmm.
Right?
And you, that's correct.
You were involved musically in the service, too, were you?
Yes, I was. Did my basic training in Manhattan, Kansas.
Oh, yeah.
Got into the band school there, and...
Didn't know they had one there.
Yes, they did. One of my colleagues, who was actually someone who was one of the cadre at the band school there, was Orr Vitam.
Oh, he's there, right? Band director at NDSU. Yeah.
That's my first meeting of Orr Vitam.
Okay, and then you went from there to Iowa.
Well, from there I was assigned to the 35th Army Band in Fort Harrison, Indiana. Mm. And there's a little story about that band which I like to tell because as you know, through World War II there was very little integration in the services. There were black units or
right.
Negro units and white units and so on. And when Eisenhower, I think it was, finally decreed that everything shall be integrated, this 35th Army Band that I was assigned to was the last unit in the whole armed services to be integrated. So it had been an all-black band. and half the personnel of the black personnel had been shipped out, and there were a number of us that were Caucasian that were assigned to the band, and so it was about a 50-50 split in black and white, and it was really a wonderful experience. It was, as you know, coming from this area of the country, we didn't know that many blacks, mm-hmm. and this was a great experience for all of us, I think, to have served in that unit in its particular makeup.
Well, that would be interesting. I thought you were going to say that the band was white and suddenly it became black or something.
No.
Okay, well then, after your sentence service, then you came back and got your PhD at Iowa. And that's the time when I got to know you pretty well, because that's when I was going to school there, too. When you got your PhD, as I recall, in composition, right?
Yes.
And performance, or...?
No, I did my master's degree in performance, trumpet okay. performance, and the doctorate is in composition.
Okay. And then, from there, you went to Milwaukee, and you were principal trumpet with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, and from that point, then you came here to Concordia, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, part of the emphasis of this oral history thing, as I understand it, is to shed some light on your art as it relates to the community and the kinds of influences that this community has had on your art and on you, I suppose. And so the next series of questions will deal kind of with that in mind. When you were here, even as an undergraduate at Concordia, and then later when you returned as an instructor here in the college, who were some of your, you know, main mentors or people who were heavy influences on you at that time? Do you recall?
Well, I recall very much or a great deal of people, many people, I should say. First one that comes to my mind is Duke Holvig, the band director at Concordia.
Mm-hmm.
He was my conductor the first 2 years that I was at Concordia, and then he retired to just teach Norse, and Leif Christensen took over the band for my junior and senior years. And I think that, you know, we all look up to our leaders at that time, and both of those men, I think, taught me a great deal of respect for ensemble playing, for band literature and music in general. It was, you know, at a time in one's life when you really looked to people for some answers, and they provided a lot of answers for me. Another one who was, I would say, quite a strong influence was Paul Christensen, conducting the choir. And he was one who I really had a great deal of respect for in his desire for perfection with the choir. It was just really a thrill to hear that group every year come up with such an intense program of such well-polished performances, and so that was kind of an ideal that I tried to strive for, or was at least influenced by in my own performance ideas. One of the very, very strong influences, and perhaps the one in my college life that had as much influence on me as anyone, and perhaps more, because he kind of guided my direction in going to Iowa, was Harold Harmon.
From Warren State.
Yes, mm-hmm. Whom you know very well, too.
Yes.
And I started studying privately with him the year after my sophomore year at Concordia. He was just new in town the year before and was very, very impressive, both he and his wife, as trumpeters in the Barmore Symphony. And I thought I could not miss the opportunity to be able to study with someone like that. And of course, he came from Iowa, so he was kind of influential in my going to Iowa, was very helpful in recommending me for an assistantship, which made it possible for me to go to graduate school. So I have a great deal to thank him for, in addition to helping me to learn how to play the trumpet better. Mm-hmm. He was influential in that respect, too. There's one more that I should say from that period, and that is one that was completely outside of the school situation, and that was Frank Scott, who at that time was at WDAY Radio, and after my sophomore year at Concordia, there was a trumpet opening in the studio band at WDAY, and I was fortunate enough to be able to fill that position, and I think that Frank Scott was, without realizing it, one of the best teachers that one could have at that time. He helped me a great deal in stylistic things, and of course listening to him play every day and improvise at the piano was quite an experience. So I count that in those years probably as my most influential people. Should mention one more. I could go on and talk about a lot of people, I'm sure, and you know, the danger is that you leave someone out. But I must also mention Ernie Harris, because at that time, Ernie was, in fact, when I came as a freshman to Concordia, Ernie was new on the staff at Concordia, the chapel choir director. Uh-huh. And I sang that first year in the chapel choir under Ernie's direction, sure. Can't you tell my beautiful voice?
I was going to say, we have not heard that since then.
Well, that's another story. But I enjoyed that experience very much. And then when I was a senior, Ernie Harris was assigned the task of taking over the counterpoint class. And we studied very intensely 16th century counterpoint for a semester and 18th century counterpoint for a semester. And I must admit that in spite of Sigvald Thompson's patience and strong influence in harmony and so on, that I had not taken a very strong interest in composition from taking harmony and ear training. I kind of took it as a necessity for the music program. But somehow in this counterpoint class, Ernie Harris was very encouraging to me, for one thing, and I just seemed to enjoy writing, and the fact that we wrote little pieces and performed them, both in 16th and 18th century styles, kind of tweaked my interest, so to speak, in composition. And at that time I had no real thought of going on and doing graduate work in composition, but I remember very distinctly Ernie Harris always telling me many times during that year, you know, what are you planning to do and so on. He says, whatever you do, I would certainly encourage you to, you know, to always do some writing, you know, take some writing courses. So when I went to Iowa, even though I was in trumpet performance, basically, I always took writing courses and formal analysis and the composition seminar, and found that to be something that I ended up really liking to do, and I credit Ernie with that a great deal.
That's interesting.
And I had a chance to tell that to Ernie many times, and I think it really pleased him to know that I had taken his advice, for one thing, and you always look for feedback as a teacher, and I think he felt good about having encouraged me in that.
I'm sure that. Yeah, that's a thing that teachers don't get enough of, generally. Positive feedback. You know, one of your main influences in your life, which I don't think you mentioned as yet, is your father. Was he not a band director, a high school band director back?
Right, yeah. Right. It's funny how you think, well, he was not actually a high school director, but he was I should say, you know, when I start thinking about influences, I started thinking in terms of my college years,
yeah,
and of course, previous to that, my father and mother were both great influences in my music career. My father was a self-taught cornet player, and one that you kind of read about. He didn't go beyond the seventh grade in his own formal education, but somewhere along the line he sent away for a cornet out of a catalog. I would assume it was Sears or something of that nature. And of course his father had been an amateur musician also in Denmark. So, but he kind of taught himself to play, I think, with the encouragement of his father, learned how to play, and actually left home when he was 16 to join a circus, Robinson Brothers.
Is this your circus. Father or your grandfather?
My father.
Is that right?
And spent about 20 years then as a traveling and itinerant musician, and played lead trumpet with, or lead cornet it was, with Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. And
I didn't know that, Bob. That's interesting.
Played. He was with the old Sells Floto Circus, which was a circus that was the size of the Ringling Brothers back in the early teens, 1914, and Carl King was the conductor of that.
Is that
group,
right?
And then he later joined Carl King with the Barnum and Bailey Circus as well as solo cornet player.
Was that during Merle Evans' time then, too?
No, I was just reading of Merle Evans' death a few weeks ago and kind of comparing the age. Merle Evans was, I think, a little younger than
must
my
have been,
father.
Yeah.
My father would be 100 years old this year.
Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he was born in 1889, or that would be next year then. So my father left the circus traveling business to go into the World War I and play in a band. And then he never returned to the circus. And I think that Merle Evans started with Ringling Brothers about 1919. I saw that date in the paper.
Okay.
So my father went into the a band in 1917 and then came back and spent a good bit of time in the 20s then playing around in various kinds of pit orchestras and so on. He was playing in pit orchestras in Minneapolis when he finally decided, well, I guess I'll give this up now and go home. And
is that right? He was doing that after
after the
after
war,
the service and war and so on. That's interesting. Well, you were destined to become a musician, obviously. What, you said your mother was in, was she a musician?
Well, she was very amateur musician. She played piano and sang, of course, and her father was a school teacher in North Dakota and also a choir director, you know, an amateur choir director.
Mm-hmm. Church choir and stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he, I think he had a community choir. He was up from around Niagara and Michigan, North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a lot. He used to do a lot of arranging for choirs and things like that.
Oh,
I've seen
really?
Some of his old manuscripts are kind of interesting, of old.
Do you still have some of those?
Well, they're in the family.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And they passed through here a couple of years ago. I was looking at some of the old boxes of his things, and he wrote out a lot of music, mostly just arrangements of
that's interesting. Students. Well, you had it from both sides. You just didn't have a choice, did you? You had to get into music one way or another.
Well, it's a choice that I was very happy to make, and very happy for the encouragement that I received from my parents in the beginning.
Yeah. Well, then, if we can move on, you pursued the college orchestra position here, or you conducted the orchestra for, well, all these years since you've been here, since 66, was it, when you first came?
66.
And then the orchestra actually formed in 67 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's grown immensely since then. It's developed into a first-class college organization. In fact, sometimes I question, Bob, whether you get more enjoyment out of conducting that group than you do the FM Symphony, and I'm sure there's some comparisons there you may want to avoid making at this point, but I'm sure there must be a great deal of reward in conducting that group as well as the FM Symphony. I'd like to concentrate, if I could, a little bit on the FM Symphony. Now, you assumed its directorship from Sigvald Thompson, and that was in the year of 68 or so, or?
No, 74.
74, well, then much later, okay. I didn't realize you'd been here that many years at Concordia before you took responsibility of the local symphony. And that means now that you've been going at it for 14 years almost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is the 14th season.
Has this been a real labor of love, or I'm sure it has to some extent, but is it indeed a rewarding experience for you? Has it met at least some of your expectations? And another thing I want to ask you about, if I can confuse you with another question, is that you, in taking on the orchestra, that was the same time that you left conducting the college band. And I'm sure that caused some misgivings on your part, too, to leave a going organization and giving that up and then going into the orchestra. What are your feelings on that?
Well, that's a very complicated thought, really. And part of it has to do with I guess, what my intentions in life have been. Oddly enough, I never really intended to be a conductor in the first place. I, of course, enjoyed playing the trumpet. And
that was your first love, performance,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. And I actually didn't start conducting until about my sixth, in the middle of my sixth year out of seven at Milwaukee. And the head of the department there was the band director. And he was very busy with administrative duties, and in the fall of that sixth year, he said, asked me if I would be interested in taking the band for the second semester, and it never really occurred to me to conduct. In fact, I in many ways tried to avoid it, but just from the standpoint of I've never felt comfortable standing in front of a group. And that may sound strange, but it was the case. I felt much more comfortable sitting in the back row in the trumpet section and just doing my part.
And hiding back there.
Yeah,
stand.
Yeah. Strange for a trumpet player to sound that
way. Yes.
But I always believed that I was inwardly outward, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
I thought about it for quite a while, and finally I said, well, yeah, I'll take it for a semester. I thought, what can I lose by doing that? And I found that conducting the band at the university there was really fun. And I found that it was possible to be guiding how a musical event went, rather than just being one of the participants. And not that that's such a bad deal either, but the responsibility, in other words, for whatever, however musical a group can produce, was a very new experience for me. And I was, I was 35 years old when I first tried that. So I'm really kind of late in start, it's kind of a late time to start conducting. But I did enjoy it, and then of course the retirement of Leif Christensen made an opening here for the band, and somehow having kept in touch with Concordia, the alma mater, I had the opportunity then to come back and conduct the band here. And also I was still very interested in orchestral literature
Did you have some misgivings at that point of coming back into a band situation?
Not really. I was enjoying it very, very much. And The thing that was very attractive about coming to Concordia was that, Paul Christensen visited in Milwaukee and said that he always had wanted an orchestra on the campus. And if I were to come and conduct a band, he would like me to start an orchestra. And so I thought, well, it was kind of a decision that at that point, do I want to put my emphasis now in, conducting and not give up playing, but, you know, at least lessen the emphasis on that part of it. And to me, it was kind of a good choice, and I tried to reason it out as best I could and make the right decision. You never know, but you make a decision finally and then go with it. So that was the, you know, attraction to come back here. And of course, conducting the band here and also starting the orchestra meant that I had two groups to manage, and plus teaching classwork and private lessons and so on in brass as well.
You must have had a really full load.
Yeah, I did. And I also, the first year I had two bands here too. I did the
cover
band. And then after that we got someone else to start doing that, so that relieved that a little bit. But when the opportunity then came along in 1974 to conduct the Fargo Moritz Symphony, which we're getting back to your question now, it was really a matter of what do I do? Do I give up the college orchestra, which I had, you know, struggled to get going, or give up the band? And it seemed to me that if I was going to take the Fargo Moorhead Symphony position, that it would be better for me to stay within one medium. And so I reluctantly gave up the band. I enjoyed every minute of the band, and still.
And I know your students were very reluctant to see you go, because I had a daughter who was among them who came home shedding tears when she discovered that you were leaving the band program in favor of conducting a symphony. Well, that's very interesting. Was there a point, Bob, at which you, let's talk about you. You know, you're such an unusual person in that you have so many fortes going for you. You're a fine performer, you're a conductor, you're a composer. And all this even without public school teaching experience. I don't understand how you could do that.
I went to public school, that's why.
Yeah, okay. you have all those and among other things, but was there a point in your career that you have switched emphasis, other than you talked about from performance to conducting? What about composition? Has that always been kind of an integrated part of your career, or do you feel you're doing more with that? And I know you're doing some writing and have successfully done other writing. Are you doing more of that now than you used to, or where does the compositional thing fit in?
Well, that's again a very complicated question. I'll try to give a simple answer if I can, but I have to go back a little bit too. Now, I mentioned that I spent 7 years in Milwaukee, and that was of course after leaving Iowa and having finished my degree and so on. And during the time that I was in Milwaukee, those 7 years, I actually did not write anything. I suppose you could call it a time of performance and teaching, but mainly performance. I was very busy. There were a couple of years that I was full-time with the symphony and full-time at the university, and our family was young, very young at that time, and took a lot of time in between, so I didn't write a note. And that entered into my decision to come back to Concordia as well, was that it seemed as though there would be more opportunities for me to, you know, to write. And I'll have to say that there are many things that I really love to do, but I think the one that gives me the most lasting satisfaction is writing music. And I've thought about that, of why that is a great deal, and I think that in a performance, even though you can record it and so on, it's still it's still something that happens and then it's done. even though it's on tape or recording and so on. But there's something about writing down music which, you know, you think that even if nobody ever plays this piece again, it's still going to be a perfect little child in the shelf, you know. and it's kind of a, you know, it's a personal expression of thought in musical terms and so on. And you think, gee, I'm glad I said that, or you might say, I wish I hadn't said that. You know? Works both ways.
Well, tell us a little bit about your compositions. I know that your doctoral thesis, as you said, was that a trumpet concerto?
No, it was a concerto for brass, strings, and timpani.
Oh, okay.
And
What other things have you done since then? I know of a few things, but...
Well, I wrote a number of band pieces, and that was something that when I came here as band director, I think you tend to write for the medium,
sure,
that you're dealing with, and I wrote... not a piece every year, but I suppose I wrote five or six band pieces in that first, during those 8 years. And I kind of decided that what I should do when I picked up writing again after a 7-year hiatus in Milwaukee, that I should try to write a piece every year. And most years I've done that. And there are some years that I haven't, and so it's nothing that I'm not concerned about. You know, I have to write that piece this year, but
self-imposed discipline.
Right. Yeah, I'm not that disciplined. I guess quite that disciplined. But so I've written. Then when I, of course, started to conduct the orchestra and start the college orchestra, I wrote some pieces for the college orchestra. And I was asked to write a piece for the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony in 1976, and I've had a number of commissions from, like one from the Minnesota State Arts, not the, the Minnesota Music Educators,
mm-hmm,
committee to write a piece for the Minnesota All-State Orchestra. And I've written a piece for the Southeastern Minnesota Youth Symphony, and plus a couple of pieces for the Concordia Orchestra.
Yeah.
And I'm about to, I wrote a piece, just the most recent composition that I've written was a piece which was premiered in 86, I guess, for the opening of the MCOMS. And that took a great deal of time. I spent a couple of years on that piece, actually.
I didn't get to hear that piece. Is that an extended one?
Oh, I have it right here in my pocket.
Oh, is it multi-movements, or...?
Yeah, there are five movements in that. And it was a heritage piece, and that's what I called it, the heritage suite.
Mm, okay.
And it included a prelude, dance, variations on a Scandinavian sailor's tune, and
for full orchestra.
Yes.
Yeah.
And choir and,
oh, was that
and
a,
vocal solo. Yeah.
Oh my! I wonder where it was. You, as I recall, also have written music for films. Have you not?
Yes, I have. This was a project that was the last thing really that I wrote before I left Iowa to go to Wisconsin. And this was really an art film that some people in Iowa City had put together, and they wanted someone to write music to go with the film. So that was an interesting project.
I bet. Well, you've kind of hit it in every... Well, when are you going to write something for a jazz band or something like that?
Well, I've done that too.
Have you?
Yes. Okay. I have, in fact, in my drawer I have a piece for trumpet and jazz ensemble that was written at the request of a former student of mine, Alan Dean.
Remember the name, yeah.
He's the trumpet teacher now at the University of Indiana, and was one of the trumpet players in the New York Brass Quintet.
Mm.
And he had a request that when he would go out and do clinics, there were some places that he was a actually a symphonic trumpeter, but he had a lot of jazz in his background and enjoyed doing things of that nature also, and so he asked me to write that for him.
He's still at Indiana now?
Yes, he is.
I remember the name, I've not had to tell him. Bob, let's talk a little bit about programming with the FM Symphony. How do you build a program? Now, for example, I've got one here that, well, it's the last concert, I think, in January, which on the program was the Edward Elgar arrangement of Handel's Overture in D minor, which was, I thought, a very delightful piece. And Dvorak Violin Concerto with Claudio Jaffe, is that the correct pronunciation?
Mm-hmm, a cello.
Cellist. And then the Priscilla McLean piece, the Sigvald Thompson award-winning composition. And Wagner's Siegfried's Journey to the Rhine. But when you build a program for a local audience now, the FM area, do you have any particular guidelines or rules or influences that you go by generally when you put one together?
Well, I'm influenced in a lot of ways. For one thing, I like to keep up with literature. There's a lot of traditional literature that much of it I haven't even heard yet, and I depend a great deal on public radio for listening for a lot of traditional things. And I like to see programs whenever I go to a concert. I save the program, and I like to experience programs in terms of what effect they have, because I feel that a program itself is a form. I mean, we have forms of music.
Art of building, what do you mean?
Yeah. We have forms within that form. A symphony, for instance, has a certain structure that you expect when you see a symphony listed on a program. And the whole concert itself is that, I feel, that same kind of thing. You need some particular kind of an opening piece that will get the attention of the audience and hold it for a while and get them thinking in terms of what's going to follow and so on, and how does this build up, and where is the climax of the whole program and so on. And so that formal structure is one that's very flexible, but it's very interesting, and I think that I've had some success in doing that, and I've also had some failures. There are a lot of programs that I wouldn't structure as I did again, because I felt that the rise and fall of tension and relaxation, etc., was not very well balanced. But that's basically what I try to do, is to follow what I feel to be the basic rule in any art form, and that is the balance between tension and relaxation. And if you can build up intensity and relax it in a proper way within a composition, that's part of it, and then also within the whole program.
Of course, that can be complicated, can it not, by the presence of guest soloists.
Oh, yeah.
And the literature that they choose to play, or who does choose to play what literature?
Well, we actually have that choice. Very often I will, if it's a soloist that is known for doing a particular kind of thing, of course, they always send out their repertoire. Mm-hmm. As soon as we decide, let's say we want a cellist. This might be interesting to note how the Dvorak was chosen as the piece. It was, of course, on his repertoire list, but there was another piece which I knew that he did that would have been very exciting to do had the rest of the program not had a certain structure to it. And that is, he's from South America, of course, and a countryman of Hector Villa-Lobos. Mm-hmm. And there's a Villa-Lobos concerto that I heard a tape of him, of Claudio Jaffe, performing, and it's really an exciting piece. But we were already committed to doing the McLean piece, which was our contest winner, and I felt that another rather contemporary sounding piece would not balance that. In other words, there would be too much tension. And so the Dvorak, of course, is probably the most, I don't know if it's the most played or not, but certainly the most desirable from the standpoint of both the performer, the orchestra, and the listener that there is in the cello solo or concerto literature. So that seemed to be a natural choice, given the other things on the program.
What about representations of different times of history of music? I mean, composers and so on. Is that a real consideration, or?
I certainly like to cover all the periods. The most material available for the full use of the orchestra, of course, is the 19th century, and spilling over into the 20th century. And then the 18th century, of course, when you think of in those terms of Haydn and Mozart, it's a little different kind of symphony, but those things balance very well with a piece from the 19th century and a piece from the 20th century. So very often, I'll try to touch on all three of those periods, and then even going one century more back, get into Bach and Handel. And
in your opinion, Bob, and of course you have to speak with the bias, I'm sure, but the FM Symphony, I think, has been very good for an organization of its size and quality in the kind of programming that they're doing, insofar as particularly as modern composers are being represented quite frequently on most of the programs. Isn't that a true, do you feel that way? Or would we be doing a lot better?
Well, I feel that we do quite well. I think there's, no matter what you play, someone is going to like it and someone is not going to like it.
Right.
And I have really a kind of funny anecdote, if this is not broadcast on the air or anything. I'd like to.
I don't think it will.
after the January concert this year, after we played the McLean contest winner, there was a gentleman that came up to me afterwards and said in all seriousness that if I would make a promise, he could do something for me. And he said, I'll make you an offer. He said, I'll give the symphony, he's already a contributor to the symphony. So he said, but I'll give the symphony $500 extra next year if you don't play one of those. So so I think there's an example of that. And yet there were other people in the audience that said, well, boy, that's a very unusual piece. And, kind of nice to hear something like that. Yeah. But, of course, I feel that we have, it's not really an obligation as much as it is, this is what's interesting about music literature that's being written today, and that is that composers are expressing themselves, and if somebody doesn't play their music, who's going to ever know what they said musically? And there you could use some obvious examples of, well, if somebody hadn't given Brahms a chance to hear his music, what he might not have done this or done that.
I've heard
it's more complicated than that, but that's a simplistic answer to it.
I've heard, for example, a fairly well-known, at least a regionally well-known composer, I won't mention his name at this point, but had said that just a few years back, I was at a workshop and this gentleman was present, and he made the comment, says, I never go to concerts anymore, because they're continually playing, what has been played over and over and over again, and it just doesn't turn me on anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I can't buy that, but I guess there is a point to the fact that an awful lot of programming is repeat of things that were popular hundreds of years ago. But I guess that doesn't necessarily detract from their quality or worth.
I think it's an interesting point. And recently, I don't know if you happen to see that article in Time magazine about the contemporary composer's dilemma.
Oh, yeah, I think I did, yeah.
I referred to it when I introduced the McLean piece.
Yeah.
And that triggered some thoughts in my own mind, which I've been kind of espousing for years. And one is, first of all, on the one hand, we need to find new literature always in music. And that's really a job now, because it was simpler in Mozart's time. There weren't that many people writing hundreds of different styles of music to choose from and so on. And, but now there, let's see now if I can remember what I was going to say. What did I start to say?
About the need for...
Oh, yeah, the thoughts that have been triggered in my mind and things that I've been espousing is where I started there. And that is, I've seen many articles, including that one in the Time magazine, which are very critical of the literature that symphony orchestras are playing and calling them museums and things of that nature. And first of all, I think they're insulting museums, because museums are a part of our culture.
That's
so
right.
They're using it in a derogatory sense, which is wrong. And the second part of that is that these pieces that have been written in the past are different. It's different in music than it is in any other form of art, and that is that when you perform a piece, no matter what its age is, it's being recreated at the point at which you play it. So if they want to speak in terms of being a museum, we could put all these scores up in a room and people could go in and look at them and say, here's Beethoven's 8th. All right. You know? But it's not that at all. It's Beethoven's 8th living today. And that is quite a difference than...
That's an interesting perspective, one that's not spoken of very much.
Well, as I say, it kind of irks me when I hear people say, oh, it's just a museum piece, you know. Well, heck, it's a living piece of art right at that moment, recreated.
I couldn't agree more. What about programming in general now? I read an article in American Symphony Magazine not so long ago about someone who was espousing the need for lots more bells and whistles, you know, to attract more audience, to make the American Symphony movement or symphony orchestras in general more palatable to the general public, more popular in demand and so on, by including, you know, visual things in a concert. What's your reaction to that kind of thing?
Well, I think that's a valid point. I do think we need to be concerned about developing an audience, and I'm not sure that I have solved very much in the way of what should be done to do that, because I think that if you develop people to come to the concerts to hear bells and whistles, they'll come to the concerts that have bells and whistles, and they won't go to the other things.
Well, but there is an argument, is there not, for that is one way of getting them in the hall, and once they've gotten there, possibly some of the more worthwhile things will rub
right,
off on them.
Right. I think it becomes a mixture of programming, you know, to do that. And that is a thought that I try to get to programming also, is to do something, like when we do something fairly new, like we did the McLean piece, do something that is not certainly a pop tune, but the Dvorak Symphony has been done a few times.
Yeah.
And so we try to connect with the audience in any way that we can, in many ways.
Are you solely in charge of program selection?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What are some of the benefits derived, do you feel, by the FM community from the presence of the FM Symphony?
Well, I think it's, first of all, I feel that a community orchestra such as this really serves as, if I can call it, a reflection of what's going on in the community. You know the composition of the orchestra, and you're a player, and you're a board member, and so you've been involved with the symphony for many, many years, and you know that it is really the people of the community that make up the symphony. And I think you also know the joy of performing. So it gives the community people that, the music teachers and those that are really interested in performance, it gives them that opportunity, first of all, to perform. Then, however, if it would only serve that purpose, then I think it would be, you know, falling short of a goal. Also, another goal is to then present music to the people in the community that is going to enrich their lives, whether it be the children, adults, senior citizens, or whatever. You know, there should be something there that enriches the lives of people. And I think that that we all, going back to just beating on rocks or whatever in the Stone Age, people have found that something, the order of music as it's developed and listened to and so on, does give a kind of extra meaning to people's lives. So we try to fulfill that in terms of both performers and audience, to try to make everybody's life a little richer. I know when I come away from listening to a good performance of a good piece of music that has really, you know, kind of stirred my emotions or stirred my happiness, or as you described, have the bells and whistles go on, and it makes you feel good. It's very hard to describe in words, as you know, and it's something, however, that we continually try to do. We try to talk about music in terms, but then when it comes right down to it, it's just sitting down and listening to it or playing it that really gives you your answer. And that is, if the people come away with smiles on their faces, then we've done something for the community. And if the players feel as though they've come a little closer to Beethoven or Brahms or Bach or McLean or whatever, they are much the richer for it too. I think it has an effect on everyone's life. So, sounds like a sermon on
I think that's
intimacies of music, but I think that's yeah. Its purpose. And art in general fulfills that.
Yeah, to me, I guess, you know, it helps kind of reestablish your contact with being human or something. You know, all these emotions that you relate to, and music just kind of highlights them and makes them a part of your thinking or being. Bob, do you feel that this organization, like the FM Symphony, or activities that you've done at Concordia here, for example, have had influence other than on a regional or a local level, like more on a regional or national level? Are there musicians, for example, that you just mentioned, this Alan Dean, for example, who's gone on and on, a former student of yours? How about locally, without talking about your son, because I'm going to talk about him a little bit later, but are there a lot of people that, or some people that have been under your tutelage or that have been associates of yours that who have gone through the FM process, so to speak, and have made it rather big in other areas or other markets that you can think of?
Well, there are, I think, a number of them. I think one of our basic purposes here in all three schools, Morehead State, Concordia, and NDSU, our main focal point, I think, has been for teacher education and for liberal arts kinds of emphasis. So that I think that even though we have from all three schools here, we have many people who have gone on in singing and performing and in composition and so on as well, and have really made contributions to wherever they are and whatever they're doing. So that I think that has the opportunity that they had with the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony has certainly heightened what they're doing. First one that comes to mind is Peter Shirkley, of course.
Oh, yeah. Great.
He's perhaps our most most famous graduate of the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony, but we have many other players. Pam Troutwine is a member of the first violin section of the Minnesota Orchestra, and she was, you know, second violin in our orchestra when she was in high school and so on. So there are many people like that who have gone on and are still performing, but I would say the bulk of the people have turned their experience around in our schools here and with the symphony to teaching and to, you know, to great effect on the depth of what they teach and so on in that experience.
Bob, what about the influence of, you know, you've been here, what, 14 years, you said. Have you noticed any particular changes in technology that has assisted or afflicted you in your work? I think, for example, the electronic keyboard, for example, which is a very common instrument nowadays in a lot of people's homes. And kids buy them and are able to, in a short amount of time, gain quite a bit of expertise and make quite a bit of music in this short time as compared to the study of the piano, for example, whereby there's a lot of months and years of practice and effort being put in before any real success is met. And how is that affecting our lives today insofar as the symphony is concerned, and as far as your teaching is concerned? Do you have any reflections on that?
Well, I think there's always a danger of the technology spreading us out too thin and, in a sense, maybe making things a little bit too convenient, if that's possible. We look in the electronic area now. I know that it's possible to sit down at a keyboard and play something and press a button and it'll print out, you know, and you could sell it right on the spot there. Unfortunately, my own technology in that area is still in the area of the monastery. I still copy out every note by hand and have not reached the state of technology of what I would dream to do, and that's one thing that I'm looking forward to doing. However, I would like to get the computer involved a little bit in my own composition. If nothing else, from the standpoint of saving hours and hours of copying, because it is possible to put a whole score in the computer now and then press a button and go to sleep, and the next morning all the parts will be run off.
Amazing.
Either that or your house is burned down.
Yeah. There's a gamble there either way.
Yeah.
Have there been any particular, during your tenure here, Bob, any particular, what you'd call, mountaintop experiences that stand out over most others? Either as FM Symphony conductor, or teacher at Concordia, or performer, or...
Well, I feel really very fortunate in having had so many good experiences here. It would almost be unfair to say one stands out, because I really had some real thrills conducting the band at Concordia, and I've had some real thrills conducting the college orchestra, and some real thrills conducting the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony. And I think that, you know, as I say, it would be hard to touch upon any individual thing. Perhaps the thing that I do most now, of course, is most concerts each year with the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony, and one of the highlights in that has been the contact with the touring artists that we have as guest soloists, who come in and I think they really leave a lot with the community. I mean, they are usually the kind of people that will we'll turn on the musicians in the orchestra and please the audience, just what I was talking about earlier in terms of what our function is. And so they always leave a little bit, and it's a musical memory that enriches our lives. And I wouldn't say one above another, I guess.
Okay, well, I think we're drawing down to a close here. We've been going on quite a while, but I want to ask you one more profound statement, Bob, and that is, how has your work affected you or your personal philosophy on life? I mean, dealing in music, I mean, maybe we've kind of touched on this already, but do you sense any closer feeling to your creator, or I guess any artist would, if you feel that you've been successful at doing something and you create a piece of artwork that you are satisfied with or that you think is pleasing others. What do you think? Are you?
Well, I certainly talk to God a great deal, and I have found He doesn't talk back to me.
It's a one-way conversation.
No, not being facetious about it. I think that the very thing that I described in recreating earlier compositions, that is really the feeling that gives me the most satisfaction in writing, the feeling that you've written down, and not that as I wouldn't be presumptuous enough to say that 100 years from now anybody will ever dig out a piece of mine and play it, but at the same time I feel that it has been a spiritual thought that I've put down on paper that is there, should anyone ever do that. And that's the connection that I kind of feel with Bach and Beethoven. Sometimes when you're performing these composers that have left such indelible marks on the music world, you feel as though their soul is right there, you know, and it is a very deep feeling. And what I try to do in my own composition, in relating it to that, is just to try to get that, that working at it in the same way as I think they worked at it, you know, that there is a lot in the universe in the way of sound, which is, a gift of nature in a way, and the harmony and rhythm, all these things are, all the basic elements of music are, in a sense, God-given, and then it's up to human beings to put them together, either in the form of a composition or in the form of a performance, and it's a great responsibility, and I feel the weight of that often. Even to the effect that sometimes when writing a piece and it's not going well, I think, well, you know, who needs this? But on the other hand, you keep trying and so on.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that a great deal. Thank you. I can't let you go, however, without a quick comment or two about your son George, who is a very successful young conductor in Washington. And Spokane, is it, at this point?
No, Spokane is history.
Is that right? He's gone from there already.
Yeah.
No, where is he now?
Well,
tell us just a little bit about him. Now, he's, recent award did he get?
He just turned 30, so
okay.
He's a 30-year-old conductor, and it's kind of interesting to think of in terms of, I mentioned earlier that I didn't really conduct until I was 35.
And here he is.
He's got a whole career behind him already, 30. At 30, you know.
Yeah.
He went to Concordia, majored in piano, studied with Roy Stahl, and went on to Indiana, spent 3 years there, received a master's in piano performance, and started in on the doctorate in conducting. Really had in the back of his mind all of this time he has been kind of preparing for conducting. That's what he wanted to do. And then he was at Eastern Washington University for 2 years, following the 3 years in Indiana. And then took advantage of a Rotary scholarship from this region and spent a year in Vienna studying conducting. And spring of that year is when he entered the contest, the International Conductors Competition in Budapest, Hungary, which is sponsored by the government, but basically by Hungarian television, which is state-owned in Hungary. And won first place in that, and as a result of that, had a number of opportunities for guest conducting concerts in Europe, and in fact is going back again this spring now to Budapest, and will probably be going back yearly for quite a while as a result of that. But he came back then, he had resigned from Washington, and spent last year, which would be the 1986-87 year, at Curtis.
Oh, is that right? Cincinnati.
Yeah, Cincinnati. And studying, conducting with Otto Werner Mueller, who was the head of the conducting program there at Curtis. And then in the spring, he auditioned for a position as associate conductor of the Birmingham Symphony, which is where he is this year.
That's right, I knew that too.
And that has been a great experience for him. And then just a matter of a few weeks ago, in January, in fact, he auditioned to become associate conductor of the Atlanta Symphony and was chosen for that position. So next September, he'll be assistant conductor at the with the Atlanta Symphony in Georgia.
And who's principal there? Conductor? The choral director?
Robert Shaw has been the conductor there for many years, and he's retiring to a conductor emeritus position, although he'll be doing several concerts, the choral concerts. And Noel Levy is the new music director there, so George will be his assistant. And he'll be doing basically the same thing he is in Birmingham this year. He'll do a lot of run-out concerts, and he'll do at least one of the main subscription concerts and children's programs, and it's a real learning
experience. And he starts there when?
In September.
September. Of 88, yeah. That's exciting, Bob. I'm sure you're going to be very proud, and I know that you have a couple other sons that you're very proud of, too, and they're not involved in music as heavily as George is. Well, this has been most interesting, and do you have any other comments or things or that you want to bring to any of these historical listeners that are going to be listening to this tape?
When will this be listened to?
Good question, Bob. Maybe never.
Maybe never?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, if I had known that. Is the machine on?
It's still on.
Oh, okay. No. Just anybody that would ever listen to this, I can't imagine that they would be that interested to listen all the way through. I would hope that everyone could experience music as a part of their life, and it certainly has been an important part of my life, and hopefully to many others as well.
Thank you, Bob. My pleasure.